so used to no one looking at me when I'm talking, except those two mopes that I have sitting next to me all the time.
You know, said the first cop, speaking in a conciliatory tone, she almost died in that fire.
Hi, Ma. How are you? I miss you. How was class? Have you made any black friends yet?
Hi there. Welcome to the Front Room. I'm your host, Scott Smith. Tonight, you'll hear five stories about the South Side of Chicago. Stories about assumptions, reforming your life, growing up, a murder mystery, and what happens when your mom tries to pick your friends. This is Volume 8, and it was recorded on January 19th, 2017, at Beverly Woods Restaurant. It was the last day of the Obama administration. You can judge for yourself whether or not that's reflected in what you hear. A quick word about the two-month gap between this episode and the last one. Sorry. Before we get started, I want to let you know about our next show, which will be Thursday, April 19th, at the Beverly Arts Center at 111th and Western at 7:30 p.m. This is our third anniversary show, and it features advocate and musician Colleen Hart Kazabowski, founder of Mothers Against Senseless Killings, Tamar Manessa, author of Folk Tales of the Middle West, Edward McClelland, Alderman Ricardo Munoz, and Funny Haha host Claire Zolke. For reader bios and more, visit thefrontroom.com. As always, our shows are co-produced with the Beverly Area Arts Alliance, and you can find them at beverlyarts.org. And now, on with the show. Our first reader is John Chats. John grew up and lived in Evanston and the north side of Chicago most of his life, until moving to the south side in July 2010, when he married his wife, who was a lifelong Southsider. He's an English major who was convinced to go to law school by his father to carry on a family lawyer history. He spent a few years practicing law, then 17 years working for Cook County courts, and is now a consultant for a large tech company advising justice agencies. Between he and his wife, they have seven kids, one who is five, and as he says, quote, is 100% ours and was born on the South Side. As occasionally happens, we had some technical difficulties with John's recording, so he was kind enough to re-record it at his home one Sunday afternoon. 5 years ago, he started writing a blog for Chicago Now called It's Never Just Black and White, focusing on his new South Side status, his biracial marriage, and other big family, big city issues, all of which features heavily in his story.
6 years ago, I got married and moved to the South Side of Chicago, specifically the Beverly neighborhood. A fairly simple statement in and of itself, but let me fill in some details. It's my second marriage, having had four kids the first time around who are now ages 30 to 22. Next, I am Jewish, the son of a Holocaust survivor, and my wife is African-American and has two sons from her first marriage, ages 22 and 19. There's more. 5 years ago, we had a baby, a little girl named Sasha. That's seven kids for those who are following along. Finally, I'm a lifelong Northsider who, prior to getting married, had been south of 35th Street and White Sox Park for something other than a wake or a political fundraiser exactly one time, the June 11, 1982 Jerry Cooney-Larry Holmes heavyweight championship fight. With all those things to consider, I will say that the move from one end of Chicago, I was living in Evanston immediately before we got married, to the other has not been quite what I expected. While it was logical, since I was living in a small two-bedroom apartment and my wife owned a home in Beverly, making the move has not only been geographically challenging, but somewhat of a cultural sea change. With that as background, about a year into my new South Side life, and speaking of sea change, I learned that my wife was pregnant. Shortly thereafter, it became time to deal with the mixed-race baby issue. I was sitting in my office at the time when one of my coworkers called and we started talking about my wife's pregnancy. How's she feeling? How are all your other kids taking it? Have you picked out names? Does she have morning sickness? To me, it's an odd thing how women feel no hesitation to ask personal questions whether they know you well or not. Guys don't do this. My male coworkers and friends barely brought the pregnancy subject up. When they did, it was more in the form of empathy for my perceived plight than anything else. You doing okay, bro? They'd rather talk about the Blackhawks anyway, and so, frankly, would I. So, during the question and answer session with me, she first wanted to know if we knew the baby's sex and if we had picked out names. My questioning coworker is black, and I remember she asked me if I liked Elliot as a boy's name. I actually do. And then when I made a joking comment that Elliot has a very white name, she said, you know, your baby is going to be black. Immediately I responded, don't think so. You know, Sherry is not real dark and I'm, well, you know, so black isn't possible. I'm not talking about that, she answered. In the eyes of society, your child will be black. At that point, 7 or so months into the pregnancy, whether it was my age, my naivety, or just ignorance, I hadn't given much thought to this concept. Of course, my wife and I had discussed having a biracial or mixed race child, and we had discussed raising a child with a Jewish father and a Christian mother. We talked about the best places to live and raise our child, but I have to say, we never talked about having a black child. My coworker, who is married to a black man, has 3 daughters herself. At one point, she had explained to me, before my wife was pregnant, that she named her first 2 daughters, Kate and Andrea, so that when the classroom teacher is reading names from an attendance sheet or an admissions person is looking at an application, there won't be an immediate assumption that the children are black. That's kind of strange, I told her. That's kind of reality, she told me. What happened to the concept of a biracial or mixed race child, I wondered. She continued, you can call the child biracial, but everyone will think of her as black. It's not like how your people determine if the child is Jewish based on the fact that the mother is Jewish. If one parent is black, the child is black. That's just how it is. To me, this is not, never has been, a skin tone issue, but an identification question. How will a child raised by a black mother and white father identify him or herself? The more I looked into the issue, talking to people and reading what I could find, the more it seemed that she had a point, and I started to think that I must be some kind of fool to have not even considered this before that conversation. Perhaps my foolishness is based on the fact that race hasn't really mattered to me, while it still does matter to, obviously, a significant segment of our society. I heard former President Obama refer to himself as a biracial black man. That's his conclusion, his characterization, and as such, could be good enough for the rest of us. But with race and the difficulties that people have in discussing the issues and accepting each other, nothing ever seems good enough. Fast forward 5 years, and now, as the parents of a biracial child, I'm much more educated on things like the one-drop rule or the interactions between black, white, and biracial middle school children. But regardless of those theories, it's our job to create the proper foundation to do whatever we can to ensure that our daughter grows up confident and secure with whatever she sees in the mirror. But before things get too serious, how about a cautionary tale involving coffee, nannies, skin tone, and that same biracial baby? My wife and I admittedly had some fun imagining what the tone our biracial baby's skin might be when she was born. I am not what some would consider pasty white. I'd say I'm more Mediterranean and darker than some white people. Hard to tell, of course, in the dead of winter when all white people in Chicago have the same pale, languid pastiness. While my wife is kind of medium brown, or as she describes herself, mocha latte. People say, yes, people know these things, that a biracial child's skin tone will have taken root after about 5 or 6 months. However, in our case, after about 5 or 6 months, Sasha's skin color was as white as Dick Cheney. This fact doesn't satisfy certain people who are looking for some sign of color. A relative saw the baby at multiple family functions, and each time over 3 consecutive months said to me, boy, her coloring is sure coming in now. It's funny how people see what they want. My audible response to her was, yeah, it sure is. Didn't match my thought of what color and what baby are you talking about exactly? Her pink cheeks or the notebook paper white color of her fingers? Let her think what she wants, I figured. A couple weeks later, a lady stopped me in the parking lot of Mr. Swifty, the dry cleaners just a few blocks north of here, as I was carrying Sasha inside and said, what a cute baby, what is she? Still not thinking about a cultural response, I wanted to say, hey, do you really think I'd dress a boy in this pink hoodie? But rather I just answered straight and polite, she's a girl. The lady's response was, no, I meant, is she Irish or Italian? Pasty skin, pink clothes, south side of Chicago equals an Irish or Italian presumption? I didn't tell her she's a mixture of Jewish, Russian, and black. I didn't think she'd be able to handle such a jolt early on a Saturday morning, nor did I feel like getting into that discussion with the stranger at the cleaners, but you get the idea. The take the cake examples of that baby looks white but is really black and people will say anything to someone with a baby phase involved the question my wife asked as she rolled Sasha up to our local Starbucks at 103rd and Longwood in the stroller. As an aside, mothers seem so proud when they walk with a new baby in the stroller, while dads seem kind of slumped over, eyes darting around to make sure no one who knows them catches a glimpse. Personally, I try to push the stroller with one hand to show that I'm really not pushing a baby in a stroller. But as my wife reached the destination, a couple approached her in the Starbucks parking lot, and the woman said, we've seen you in here a few times recently, and we have a baby too. Do the baby's parents live in the neighborhood? If human eyes were loaded and could shoot, yes, they live down the street and I'm the baby's mom. Women can be cold and much scarier than men when crossed, especially when it involves family. It doesn't take a lot of words to make a point. Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I just thought, mm-hmm. And then they were gone up the street. I think they're getting their coffee at another Starbucks these days. But my wife and I are still here, along with our white, black, mixed Italian, Irish, Russian, Jewish, Christian, African daughter. Finally, to the present day, as a white man, good or bad, I look like a Trump supporter. In mid-November, I was driving west on 115th Street in Morgan Park, leaving the gym on a sunny, warm autumn afternoon. My car windows were open, and as I approached Vincennes Avenue, I glanced to my left and saw two young black men walking west on the sidewalk. I looked at them, and they looked at me, and one of them shouted in my direction, "Fuck Donald Trump!" I responded and shouted, "Damn right, fuck him!" Realistically, was there any point to that exchange? Ultimately, none. Trump is president-elect, and as long as I drive down 115th in Morgan Park, young black men will probably assume that I am a Trump supporter. Can't say that I blame them. It's not like I have a sign around my neck or a bumper sticker on my car that reads, "I'm married to a black woman, don't blame Trump on me," or hashtag not my president, or "I'm a Jew, he hates me too." I actually thought about my appearance betraying me during this entire election cycle, and more recently when a guy got pulled out of his car and beat up, and again when the guy was kidnapped and beat up. And for that moment on 115th Street, I guess I'd assume I supported Trump too if I was black and looking at me. A recent Washington Post story described a white Trump supporter. "I've never voted in my life until this," said Dave Fisher, who used to make good money salvaging metal in Pittsburgh. "There's never been anyone I really cared about. He put a spark in everything. He makes you want to be an American again. And that's what I've been looking for." As a person with two grandparents and one parent who were born outside the United States, I've never had a problem with being an American, now or at any time growing up. Nor did Donald Trump put a spark in everything for me. Sorry, Dave, but if that's what you needed to put a spark in your life, you're in the hell of a disappointment. Because as far as I can tell, Donald Trump doesn't give two shits about you now and won't going forward. On the other hand, perhaps Dave and others were fortunate they were able to simply find someone that they could rally around and who spoke what they wanted to hear. For me, however, driving in Chicago, I'm stuck now being a white man who looks like a Trump supporter.
John's blog, It's Never Just Black and White, is updated regularly on the Chicago Now platform. You can find a link to it, as well as the show notes for this podcast, with links to all our readers in their bios, at thefrontroom.com. Our next reader is Eric Charles May. Eric is the author of the novel Bedrock Faith, which was named a notable African-American title by Publishers Weekly. The 2015 recipient of the Chicago Public Library Foundation's 21st Century Award, Eric is an associate professor in the fiction writing program at Columbia College Chicago and a former reporter for the Washington Post. His short fiction has appeared in Criminal Class, Fish Stories, F, and We Speak Chicagoese. In addition to his writing for the Post, his nonfiction has appeared in the Chicago Tribune, Sport Literate, and the second story anthology, Briefly Knocked Unconscious by a Low-Flying Duck. Eric is a Southside expat, formerly of 111th and Racine, who now lives in Lincoln Park. But Bedrock Faith takes place closer to his old home, and it's what he shared with us that night.
Hang on.
Maybe
too much. How's that sound? There we go.
All right. That sound good?
Good.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Scott. Thank you very much, and Front Room for having me here. And I live on the what?
Hold on, I'm sorry.
Okay.
My bad.
All right. and yeah, I live on the north side, but I grew up actually a good part of my life on 111th Place and Racine, and graduated from John D. Shoup School, where all my siblings graduated, and where my mother and all of her siblings graduated, and where my mother taught for much of her teaching career at John D. Shoup. This is my first time in this restaurant. As a boy, I remember driving by it many times. as a kid. And of course, the Walker Branch Library was my home away from home when I was a little boy. My novel is about a guy who is terrorizing his neighbors with the word of God. He gets out of prison after 14 years, moves back home with his widow mom. His staid middle-class African-American neighbors are very worried because he was quite the terror when he before he went away. But they find out that while in prison, he's had a religious conversion. But then they find out that he's much more of a problem as a born-again warrior for God than he was when he was just a thug. Because now he sets himself up as the religious judge and jury of the block and the neighborhood, which is a fictional neighborhood I invented called Parkland. I figured it was the quintessential Chicago neighborhood name. And then he starts getting into it with one neighbor after another. And then some of the neighbors start to retaliate, and that ups things even more. And what I'm going to read from this evening is from actually in the last third of the book, and one of the neighbors, a teenage boy named Reggie, has decided that he's going to burn down this guy's house while nobody's home with a Molotov cocktail. But he overthrows from the backyard, and it sails past his intended target and hits the house next door and burns it down. And the house is owned by a widow by the name of Mrs. Motley. And he's got gasoline-stained clothes, and the arson cops are onto him, and they take him into custody. But they don't quite have enough to arrest him, and what they're trying to do is to get him to confess. And Mrs. Motley, who owns the house, has already figured out that Reggie is the person who burned down the house, and she has already told him, you are not to tell anybody what you did. But she tells him, my house is not worth your life. And so Reggie is with these two arson police officers in a windowless room, and and they're questioning him and going back and forth. And the cops then shifted gears in their questioning. The first cop asking Reggie if he was thirsty. When Reggie said yes, the other cop asked if he wanted a can of pop. Reggie, taking this as a hopeful sign, said yes. And the cop asked him what sort of pop he wanted. And Reggie named one, and the cop, acting as if he couldn't be helpful enough, got up and left, returning soon after with a cold can, which he opened for Reggie and placed in front of him, just like a waiter does in a restaurant. And as Reggie sipped the pop, feeling so good in his dry mouth, the cops explained that they knew he was a good kid, that he got good grades and was a good basketball player. We'll probably see you on TV playing in the Final Four someday, one of them joked, which Reggie also took as a good sign. You're an all right kid, said the other, not like some of the punks we have to chase around the streets. So we know you're not the kind of person to intentionally set out to hurt somebody like Mrs. Motley. She's such a nice lady. Of course, she's lost her house and everything in it. She's homeless, essentially. A retired old lady living on a pension. Now she has nothing. The cops were then silent, giving that last point a chance to run around Reggie's mind. He lowered his head. You okay, Reg? Head still down, Reggie nodded. In his mind, he could see Mrs. Motley's house blazing, but he also saw her face close to him when she had cupped his face in her soft hands and told him not to tell anyone. You know, said the first cop, speaking in a conciliatory tone, she almost died in that fire. That's what the fire battalion chief told us the other night. By all rights, she ought to be dead. That's how close the person who set this fire came to killing that poor woman. Imagine what her nightmares must be like now. As that punch hit Reggie, the other cop followed with the second blow of the combination. speaking in a way a kindly pastor might do with someone from his flock who'd come in for guidance. You know, Reggie, when a wrong's been done and a person has the power to make amends, it's that person's responsibility to do so. You know what I'm talking about, right? Reggie, his head still down, nodded, and a tear fell onto the table. It embarrassed him to be crying in front of these white men, and he knew that he had promised Mrs. Motley to not tell anyone, but he had hardly slept the last two nights because of what he'd done. He was so tired, and he so much wanted to tell someone, just to get it out, which might relieve this pressure that was building inside of him so bad he felt like he might suffocate. He began breathing hard, and the first cop, in a voice that couldn't have sounded more sympathetic, said, "Is there something you want to tell us, Reggie? Get it off your chest. We are ready to listen." And Reggie's shoulders slumped, and the cops continued to be patient in their nudging him to where they knew the decent and honest and good part of him wanted so desperately to go, and had probably been wanting to go since Saturday night. They had seen people in this situation before, of course, and they could sense he was almost there, seconds away maybe. Once it was out, they'd have enough for an arrest and a search warrant for the garage to get the gas can and the lighter, which would seal it. And then, in the quiet of their anticipation, there came a soft knock on the door. With the silence so tense, the knock had the effect of a much louder sound, like someone hard kicking the door. All three were startled. Reggie's head shot up, and the cops, momentarily caught off guard, displayed angry faces. They quickly regained their magnanimous expressions, but saw that Reggie had noticed their anger, and they knew that the spell they'd worked so hard to build had been broken. They turned to the door behind them to see what moron had interrupted their interrogation. The brown-haired head of a clean-shaven uniformed lieutenant, who had a bold chin and a nameplate that read O'Reilly, leaned through the space of the partially open door. The first cop was about to ask, while working to keep his fury in check, what this O'Reilly wanted, when the lieutenant, in his crisp white blouse and gold shoulder bars, stepped inside the room, followed by a man in an impeccable dark suit. Dark blue, double-breasted. At first, the cops thought the suit was a white man, so light was his complexion. But then they recognized the toothy smile they'd seen so often on TV. He was Scotty Woodbury, one of the best defense lawyers in town. Speaking amiably, like someone who'd arrived late for a friendly poker game with pals, Scotty Woodbury said, "Hey there, guys. I need to speak with my client." Thank you.
Eric's book, Bedrock Faith, can be purchased from Akashic Books or found on your favorite ebook platform. Our next storyteller is Robin Baumgarten. Robin is a three-time Emmy Award winner and co-anchors the WGN Morning News from 6 to 10 a.m. She joined the show in 1996 as airborne traffic reporter and transportation reporter. In addition to anchoring, Robin enjoys reporting on stories unique to Chicago and the South Side. Prior to joining WGN-TV, Robin worked at Shadow Broadcast Services in Chicago. During that time, she worked as a traffic, news, and sports reporter for WLUP Radio's Jonathan Brandmeier Show. She also worked as a traffic reporter for CLTV News and spent 1 year doing freelance work with ABC Sports. Robin received a bachelor's degree in broadcast journalism from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Born and raised in South Suburban Burbank, Robin had plenty of stories to share about life on the South Side.
All right, we ended up sitting Robin in the back, so you're going to keep having to clap, because otherwise it's just going to be awkward. First time doing anything like this.
This is bizarre.
Nice. No booing.
I'm so used to no one looking at me when I'm talking, except those two mopes that I have sitting next to me all the time. I remember coming here, like, to weddings when I was a child, and I distinctly remember this chorus line backdrop. I love how some things never change. God bless them. You know, so I'm going to start out by using some words of my father. Every time he comes and, like, hears me talk or something, he's like, for God's sake, be quiet. So he's given me his rules of public speaking. He has the 5 B's of public speaking. Be brief, baby, be brief. So I'm going to try, because the two people before me were so good and compelling, and they've done this before, and I am a novice. So I'm just going to say that, you know, working on the North Side, I lived on the North Side for about 15 years, and I live in Orland Park now. People always ask me, what is it like growing up on the South Side? Or, you know, Larry will be like, what's it like when you go south of Madison Street? It's very scary. And I'll be like, well, when you go down there, people are going to ask you what parish you're from, if you have teenage daughters, if they meet someone to go out on a date, the guy's going to have something called a scapular on. It's okay. You might think you're in France because every banquet hall is a chateau. On the North Side, they have BMWs. On the South Side, we have the BMC, the beef mustacholi and chicken at every wedding and graduation party. The thing I love about the South Side, though, is everybody is real down here, you know? I tell you, I married someone from the North Side. That didn't work out so well. And I was going outside of my circle. That's what you get, right? But people are so generous down here. I swear, having lived on the North Side and South Side, some of the most genuine, generous people that you get wedding gifts, it's all cash. You go up north, they're giving you a vase that you're never going to use. I'm just telling you, I got a million of them. The thing, though, about, you have to realize that when you're on TV and you're from the South Side, when people see you, they're going to feel like they can tell you anything, honestly. So I love telling this story about when I moved back to the South Side and I was at church. You know, you go to church every week, you're trying to, well, I used to. Trying to get the kids to go to church every week, and I, you know, you see the same people, and it's always, you know, people like my parents' age that keep coming to church every week, and they'd be like, hey. This older lady comes up to me one day and goes, you know, I gotta tell you, you look really familiar to me, and I think I finally figured it out. Do you have a chubby cousin who works for WGN? I'm like, I do. She is so fat, she's the worst. But they're honest, you know? So I'm like, oh, you gotta look in the mirror. People are telling you the truth. People ask me what my family is like. I grew up in Burbank, you heard that mentioned. My grandma actually is 99, God bless her. She used to be a waitress at the Beverly Country Club. So it's so bizarre, I had my wedding at the Beverly Country Club, and it was, she's like, I don't know if it's okay to be up here. You know what I mean? It's so weird. I'm like, Graham, you know, it's just, everything comes full circle. My mom was a teacher and a principal. She used to teach at St. Albert, where I went to school. She was also a principal at St. Bruno and at St. Michael in Orland Park. My two sisters, one of them's a teacher and a cheerleading coach. Oh my God, we are totally at a lot of cheerleading competitions. I don't know if I've seen anyone. My daughters are both cheerleaders, so I spent a lot of time there. And my other sister works for the Score, sports radio. My dad is probably I like to say he's probably the biggest influence on my life, but it's a blessing and a curse. He's a funny guy. He grew up on the South Side, went to St. Rita Grammar School, St. Rita High School, and he's insane, but he's. I think he probably made me tough. You know, I'm one of three girls. We had to mow the lawn. We had to do everything ourselves. And, you know, it builds character. That's what he used to tell us, you know. So one of our favorite stories about my dad growing up is when my sister and I were at a party at Jim Cairo's house. I don't know if anyone knows Jim Cairo. He lived at 55th and Mozart. But I remember this story. So we go there and, you know, we have a midnight curfew. And my sister and I went and we drove, and a friend of ours left the party with my keys to the car. So it's like 11 o'clock. I'm like, oh no. So we had to call home. Dad, my friend left with the keys. Can you come and bring us the keys? He's like, where are you? I'm like, 55th and Mozart. He's like, be outside. And we're like, okay. We're standing outside. It's cold. The party's broken up by now. And all of a sudden, we see the Buick Riviera turn in the corner, 55th and Mozart. We're like, yeah, he's here. We're like, hey, Dad, over here. And he's fishtailing because it's snowy outside, and he comes down the block, and I just see the driver's side window go down, and his arm goes out the window, and he whips the keys out into a snowbank and just keeps on driving. We're like, we had to figure it out, right? That's what you do on the South Side, right? He's insane. The funny thing is, though, my mom being a teacher, it's this, you know, my mom is, you know, it's like good cop, bad cop all the time, or angel and devil. So my mom's always like, you got to study, you have to get good grades, you know, all this time. Meanwhile, my dad would sit there at the same table and be like, Dolores, they're in grade school. Doesn't count on your permanent record. Doesn't matter. Just let him. I was like, Gary, be quiet. You don't even know what you're talking about. They got to get to a good school. I don't know. Anyway, some of the lessons applied to my life and job, I think, is I'm not afraid to work hard. You know, I think the thing I learned most about growing up in this neighborhood is that you have to be yourself. People figure out if you're trying to be something other than what you are. I'm never going to be Kelly Ripa. Not going to happen. Can't happen. Just ask the lady in my parish. So you got to be who you are. You got to be real. And you know what? I like to say the South Side is full of characters that are all full of character. Some of the best people you will ever meet. And I'm raising my kids down here. And hopefully they won't be too screwed up like the rest of my family. So thank you very much for having me.
Robin Baumgarten, ladies and gentlemen. Woo. Robin's got jokes. Oh my goodness. Yeah, take that, Larry, indeed.
You can see Robin every weekday morning on WGN-TV, Chicago's very own Channel 9. Our next reader is L.D. Barnes. L.D. Barnes is a lifelong Chicagoan who's proud of her beginnings on the West Side. She attended Roosevelt University and the Art Institute of Chicago before spending her work life at several cultural, medical, political, broadcasting, and corporate institutions. Her poetry has been published on the Skinny Poetry Journal website, and one of her poems, Recipe, is included in Revising the Psalm, work celebrating the writing of Gwendolyn Brooks, which Curbside Splendor released last year in honor of Gwendolyn Brooks' 100th birthday. Her work can also be found in the Tall Grass Writers Guild anthology from Outrider Press. She divides her time between three writing groups, the Longwood Writers Guild, For Love of Writing, or FLO, and the Mystery Writers of America. Currently, she is working on a police procedural mystery trilogy set in the late 1970s with the aid of her husband Frank, a retired Chicago patrolman. The first book, The 107th Street Murder, is set in Beverly, Oaklawn, and Morgan Park, and she shared an excerpt with us that night.
Hi, guys. Now, I'm from Beverly Woods. Yay, I even walked here. Okay. In honor of the patron spirit of mystery writers everywhere, Edgar Allan Poe, tonight on his 208th birthday, I'm going to kill somebody before your very eyes. This is the first chapter of my work in progress, and it's looking for an agent or a publisher. Any of them out here? No? Okay, that's cool. Let me take you back to a hospital on 95th Street on Sunday, October 15th, 1978. It's 3:45 in the morning, otherwise known as lunchtime for the night shift. This chapter is called Tickets, Please. I'm so stoked, exclaimed Lee, doing a chair dance across the hospital lunchroom table from her friend Paula. I've won a weekend for two at the Playboy Hotel in Lake Geneva. That's bitchin'. They have suites like the Poconos, only way better. When Hugh Hefner puts a mirror on the ceiling, it's the whole ceiling, not just the part over the bed. For fun, Lee shot her a quizzical look. The Poconos? Yeah, you know, the motel, down on Cicero at 107. And how would you know? Nervously pulling at the collar of her gray housekeeper's uniform, she whispered, as her face flushed bright pink behind her brunette Farrah Fawcett hairdo. I kind of saw some photos in my dad's magazine after my brother stole it and hid it under his bed. Okay, I'll give you that. But who the hell did you go to the Poconos with? Nobody. My aunt works there. I fill in sometimes when the other cleaning woman doesn't show up. And let me tell you, it's hard to get that shag carpet they got up on those walls clean. I bet, chuckled Lee. Why can't you remember what contest it was? I want to enter. Must have been one of those boxes by the cashier in the restaurants around here. I put my name in all the time. All I know is somebody called here and left a message with my boss, Dana, saying I'd won. So, Paula, could you do me a favor? Paula glared across the table, waiting for Lee to drop a bomb. Lee always was asking for something. I need to get to the travel agency. It's down on Western. You know the one with those hokey plastic pineapples and the dusty-looking coconuts in the window? They're opening this morning for me. Could you please, please, please punch me out? Pretty please? Paula swallowed, scrunched her face, and sighed. Okay, Lee, but this is the last time. I swear, one of these days you're going to get us both fired. I need this job. Like I don't. Paula, what I need is those tickets in my hand. If I miss them, they'll give them to somebody else. They told Dana they've been trying to reach me, so this is probably my last chance. You know, I haven't been out of Chicago since our senior class trip to the Indiana Dunes. This would be like a honeymoon. As soon as the word honeymoon came out of Lee's mouth, Paula's expression changed. Using this trip for a tryst was what Lee intended to do, and the word honeymoon proved it. Paula didn't want to be an accessory to one of Lee's crimes of passion. The contest people call it a honeymoon package, not me, pleaded Lee. Come on, Paula. You know, I don't have anybody to take except Mama. Lee grimaced. Of all the lies she'd ever told, none of them have ever made her feel queasy before. Gulping hard, the sensation passed quickly. I'll do it. But this is the last time, Miss Leval Nab. We've gotten away with this too many times. We're bound to get caught sooner or later. It's the last time. Cross my heart and hope to die. Thanks, Paula. You're an absolute pal. Paula smiled weakly as Lee hopped up from the table, leaving her tray for Paula to deal with. 6:35 a.m. On Sundays, the gas station and the car dealership across from the travel agencies were closed until noon. In this glorious Indian summer weather, not even the dog walkers or the joggers would notice anything. They were too busy heading for the green strip between the cemetery and the golf course that stopped the cars from proceeding west on 107th. Only the drivers who lived on those blocks or the occasional out-of-town stranger would go past the broad pavement of Western. Everyone else would turn, heading either for 111th or 103rd Street. Lee pulled around the corner of 107th, turned into the alley to park near the back door. She was early. She'd left the hospital 30 minutes before punch-out time. It didn't matter. It was her last night to work there ever. Her badge and keys were on Dana's desk with her resignation note. And she slipped behind the wheel of Grasshopper, her 1969 MG convertible. She was fishing in her purse for cigarettes. Smoking was a pleasure she would forego at the end of this pack. She could do it easy. Working in the computer center had cut her down to damn near nothing anyway. She lit up, twisting the volume knob up as a male falsetto voice sang, "Well, I don't know how this whole business started." In the last chorus of the song, the inside lights of the office came on. She blew a smoke ring as she checked her makeup in the mirror. She could look like Olivia Newton-John if she wanted to. Flicking her half-smoked cigarette in the middle of the alley, she pulled her flannel shirt over her leggings, wiggled her wide faux leather belt, slung her hobo bag over her left shoulder. Prancing across the pavement, the click of her suede boots made her feel like she was walking a fashion show runway. Yanking the back door of the agency open with a big grin, she called out, "Hello!" Walking past cardboard cutouts of palm trees and hammocks, racks of assorted brochures, there was nobody there. Lee called out again. Noticing the washroom door was closed, Lee popped down in a client chair at the middle desk to wait, hoping whoever was there was in there. When the figure emerged, Lee's smile melted into a sneer. "Oh, damn, it's you. What the hell do you want?" "To talk with you, darling." "Well, I don't want to talk to you." "You can have the trip if you just listen," the figure said, waving the brown envelope seductively. "You'll give me a trip for just listening?" "Sure and I will. 'Tis a paid-up voucher in here. Signed and sealed, no way to cancel." Lee thought about it for a moment. Which did she want more, a luxury weekend or her untarnished pride? Quickly, she decided on the weekend. She could polish her pride later. "I'll listen." The envelope was pushed under the blotter on the end desk, covered by a heavy stapler so she couldn't snatch it and run. "Lee, I like you. You don't think so, but I do. Now, what I need to tell you is, you've gotten sloppy. That little car of yours been parked too many nights at the Miami Motel, way in the back, mind you, but right next to his truck." Lee's mouth flew open. All she could stutter was, "But." "Sure, it's hard to see from the street, traffic passing by so fast and all. But if a body's got a mind to look, it was there to see." Lee always thought she'd be ready with a litany of denial if confronted, but she couldn't get a word out. "No, no, no, dear heart. I've seen it with me own eyes. More than once, might I add. At the Midway, and the Gateway, and the Aloha, and the Florida Motel, too. You even snuck over to the Saratoga down on 79th Street, right next to the dirty bookstore, thinking that was far enough away, but it wasn't. Why, the first time, I thought it was a sweet little fare-thee-well. Once more for old time's sake, so I said nothing. But you couldn't keep those legs of yours closed now, could you? There you were, him and you, green car, red truck and all, over and over again." "I'm not going to apologize," Lee huffed triumphantly. "He loves me, he always has." "Does he now? Risking home and happiness for the likes of you." "Happiness? You think he's happy at home? What a fool you are." "Ah, fool, no. I'm a fixer. That's what I am. And I've got a solution for us all. Just hear me out." Lee could feel the heat of hate flashing behind her eyes. "You need to go now. Use that voucher. Have your fun. Live it up. Make a memory. Everything's paid for. Room service, booze, you name it. There's $500 credit at the hotel and a $100 bill in that envelope. Buy yourself something sexy. Get your hair done. Gas up your car. And when you come back, tell him it's over. Say goodbye for good. Then every month you stay away, I'll give you a tidy sum of cash." Lee let out a laugh. "You think you can pay me to leave him alone? You're the reason we're not together now. You've been listening to way too much Diana Ross. Lee put her hand up like she was holding a microphone, singing in a high-pitched, squeaky voice, touch me in the morning, then just walk away. Lee had never experienced such a look of hatred. Suddenly, the envelope was mashed into her breast with a force that pushed her and the chair back. She wanted to lunge, to hit back, but deep down inside, something doubled her up. Scuttling past her assailant, she dropped her purse, scooped up a handkerchief that was laying on the desk to hold over her mouth. She burst through the door marked restroom. Vomit erupted from her. The second wave of nausea was so strong, it made her knees sink to the floor. With her forehead near the black plastic seat, something smashed Lee at the base of her skull so hard that although her eyes stayed open, all she saw was the darkness of death.
You can read more of LD's writing at flowauthors.com. Our final reader is Jamie Nesbitt Golden. Jamie is a wife, parent, and recovering journalist who hails from Chicago. Her work has appeared on a number of sites, including DNA Info Chicago, Chicagoist, XO Jane, Salon, and Time.com. She loves liquor, historical biographies, and silence. Like most tech-savvy navel-gazers of her generation, she can be found on a variety of social networks, including Twitter, at The Way of the Id, Tumblr, and Nerdgasm Noir Network, where she co-hosted a weekly podcast with four other nerdy opinionated women. Jamie resides in Hyde Park, and her story is about the time her mother got a little too involved in her social life.
Am I that short? Jesus.
What, look, hey, I feel like I got a person who knows and my understanding.
So, as I try to figure out my iPad because I'm old, so this story isn't necessarily about a romantic date, it was more of a friend date. My mother, who passed away in 2014, was so concerned about my college social life that she set me up on a date. Because she was that type of broad. So I wrote this for XO Jane a few years back, and it's really one of my favorite stories about my mom. So I share this in honor of her, and I hope you enjoy it. Sorry, I have to put on my glasses because I'm old. So, picture it, summer 1995. By the grace of God and remarkable ACT scores, I am a newly minted freshman at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale, a school known for producing Dennis Franz and underage binge drinkers. It's mid-September, and my mother, who now calls me every morning to make sure I get to class on time, is grilling me about my new friends, all of whom happen to be white. Her concern grows with each conversation. Hi, honey. Hi, Ma. How are you? I miss you. How was class? Have you made any black friends yet? That last question was always delivered with rapid-fire speed. No, but Muffy and I went to the mall and... Oh, that's nice, baby. So in retrospect, I understand my mother's concern. She bore the scars of Jim Crow and grew up in an era where the number of white people she could trust were few and far between. An only child she relied on, cherished even, the bond she made with other black women. The ones who supported her through messy divorces and unexpected pregnancies. The ones who encouraged her to finish her GED and explore her spirituality. The ones who, like her, knew what it felt like to come home off a 10-hour shift to a home where your only support system, your only lifeline, is running around in her underoos. These connections may have formed because of a shared identity, but it was much deeper than that. So after each uncomfortable exchange, I'd make it a point to smile at every black co-ed I pass in the quad. I'd usually get a frown or a scowl in return. I would volunteer time raising money for students attending the Million Man March. I'd audition for an all-black play, no dice. So to cope, I'd write about the encounters in my journal, or call my best friend who was upstate at U of I, have the time of her life, or the hometown boyfriend I would eventually cheat on and dump 3 months later. The latter two were sympathetic but couldn't really understand, for they had long mastered what I could not for another 5 years, the art of code switching. For inner city brown kids, code switching is a survival skill. It allows one to navigate both the treacherous terrain of graffiti-strewn boulevards and AP classes. Some say it's a byproduct of Du Bois's double consciousness, the ability to communicate both with our own and the white world in a relatable, non-threatening manner. It was also something I was completely clueless about. While I wasn't quite at the level of Carlton Banks, I was close. So despite this, I managed to collect a few girlfriends and a good number of gentlemen callers. My naivete led me to believe that befriending another group of girls would be easy peasy. In the meantime, I spent my weekends in the company of white girls from various Illinois towns. Stephanie from Bethalto, Marta from Collinsville, Jessica from Mahomet, Krista from Dwight, the set of Shavs from Rantoul. They would introduce me to my first beer, my first frat kegger, and my first white boy. Life was good, identity crisis aside. Then I made the mistake of telling my mother about my plan to rush a predominantly white sorority. The silence on the other end of the phone, deafening. And then a sigh. Okay, baby, that's what you want to do. 2 days later, she would call again. Hi, baby, how are you? Minnie says hi. You remember Minnie, don't you? She's got a daughter about your age down there. Sophomore. Raven. Ravinia. Renisha. Lord, I can't remember that child's name. Anyway, Minnie says she's interested in meeting you. Here, take her number down. I did as I was told and called. Raven, Ravinia, Renisha was, well, less than enthused about the proposed meet. Nevertheless, we decided to link up at the student center the next day. Admittedly, I was nervous, so nervous that I spent the rest of the evening picking out the perfect ensemble. My wardrobe being more Freddie Brooks than Whitley Gilbert, I decided to go with my least threatening Beavis and Butthead t-shirt and the fancy pair of jeans. 12 hours later, I made my way toward the student center, the gin blossoms playing full blast on my weathered Walkman. I grab a seat near one of the dining areas playing the latest episode of One Life to Live from a large television mountain in the corner. 20 minutes later, Raven, Ravinia, Renisha arrive fashionably late, even by my tragically CPT standards, with not one, not two, not three, but four. Count them, four other broads, all wearing the same look of amusement on their faces. If this was a gang initiation, I was fucked. Raven, Ravinia, Renisha introduced herself and the rest of the Ravenettes and had a seat. What happened afterward was the most awkward 15 minutes of my life, not counting the time I brought an ex-boyfriend to my new boyfriend's house in the 11th grade. To this day, I cannot tell you what was said. Hell, I barely remember what she looked like. But I remember the pained expressions, the awkward silences, the foot shifting, and her crew giggling in the background. For a moment, I flashed back to Homecoming 1993, when I watched Helen Ferris, school pariah, and the girl most likely to destroy people with her telekinetic powers, dance around the gym to Naughty by Nature, oblivious to the people looking on with bemused pity. I was Helen Ferris. Fuck. We promised to stay in touch. Of course, I never saw her again. I would leave at the end of the school year befriending one black person. Much to my mother's dismay, he had a penis. A year later, I'd find myself at a school back in Chicago, my mysterious sister-friend problem of faint, unpleasant memory. I rarely, if ever, talked about it. For a while, it was a little painful to share. That it happened during one of the most vulnerable stages of my life didn't help my self-esteem. And 17 years later, but I'm able to find the humor in this bizarre story. 35-year-old me has a rainbow coalition of girlfriends who love and accept me as I am, and for that, I am grateful.
Jamie is now co-hosting a new show called Elevated Podcast, dropping this spring. And that's our show. This show was originally recorded at Beverly Woods Restaurant on January 19th, 2017, at Beverly Woods Restaurant in the Morgan Park neighborhood of Chicago. Our next live show will be April 19th at 7:30 p.m. at the Beverly Arts Center. Watch thefrontroom.com for updates and follow us on Facebook or Twitter by searching for The Front Room on those platforms. And be sure to check out the Beverly Area Arts Alliance at beverlyarts.org. We'll have a new Front Room episode available every month or so. No, really. I promise. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe or leave us a review on iTunes. It helps other people find the show. You can download it here or subscribe to The Front Room via iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. And you can even hear it on Amazon Alexa via the TuneIn digital radio service. The Front Room podcast was produced by me, with audio production and editing by Tim Mata. You can follow him on Twitter at Tim L. Mata. Our intro and outro theme music, which you are hearing right now, is the song Quittin' Time by Patrick Lee on Bad Panda Records. And our between story music is Ground Cayenne by The Good Logs. Both are licensed via Creative Commons at the Free Music Archive. You can find show notes for this podcast at thefrontroom.com. I'm Scott Smith, and you can follow me on Twitter at rmaninchicago or at rmaninchicago.net. And I'll see you in the Front Room.